were just doing what they wanted to do. That's a map, again, I don't know if this laser pointer will do any good at all, but when the Assyrians invaded, they invaded down the western side. They were conducting the siege of Lachish, and then they moved east and north to Jerusalem, and they actually sent messengers while they were still besieging the city of Lachish to Hezekiah in Jerusalem. I wanted to talk a little bit about the end of Lachish because some questions were brought up at the end of the presentation last week. And one thing I want to emphasize is this text is from a historian who documented the Battle of Lachish. And some of the things that he talks about was the use of archers that were brought forward. And I didn't put enough emphasis on the Assyrians used a type of composite bow for their archers. It was made of wood, bone, glue, and hide. And it allowed them to, they were much more powerful bows than the simple wooden bows that were used by pretty much everybody else. They could outdistance the Jewish archers at the city of Lachish by 2-1. And in fact, modern analysis said that these Assyrian bows were capable of shooting effectively at 300 to 400 yards. Well, that when I came in the Army, the M16A1 had a max effective range of 460 meters, which is about 475 yards. So these bows were extremely effective. And not only that, but the Assyrians, being professional soldiers, were well-trained. Over here on this picture, this area that's outlined in the red dotted line, if you can see that, that's a shield. It's a huge wicker shield, taller than a man. Every archer would have had a shield bearer who went with him. And the shield bearer and the archer, when the archer wasn't shooting, could hide behind that shield. So that even if the Jewish archers could reach them, they were concealed behind that shield. The Syrian archer could step out with a much more powerful bow and shoot. And they basically shot the Jewish archers off the wall as fast as they appeared, or at least forced them to keep their heads down. And that's what allowed the Assyrians to build that siege ramp up against the city walls and bring a siege engine up. And the siege engines were covered with wicker shields also to protect them. And this was in the day and age before nobody had really effective artillery like catapults or things like that. They could throw large stones large distances. So they were pretty much impervious to anything that the Jewish defenders at Lachish could throw at them. And this historian said that once everything was prepared, the siege engines were in place, the ramps were built, that the actual assault on the city still probably took several days just because of the ferocity of the fighting. When it was done, the remains of hundreds of people that were put to death after the city was captured were found in the archaeological digs. Again, the Assyrians were very brutal and slaughtered people willy-nilly once the battle was over. So I just wanted to touch on that because I kind of left that uncovered last time. Anyway, while the siege of Lachish was going on, the Assyrian king Sennacherib had sent his messengers, very high-ranking messengers, to the city of Jerusalem and told Hezekiah, look, I'm capturing all your cities. There's nothing you can do to resist me. Just surrender while you still have a chance. Hezekiah decides to try to buy off the Assyrians. Says, maybe if I give them enough in the way of wealth, if I give them enough treasure, they'll abandon their attack and go back where they came from. 2 Kings tells us that he gave them 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Well, I didn't check today's price, but when I prepared this slide a week and a half ago or so, at that day's price of gold and silver, that equated to about $4.5 million in silver and almost $34 million in gold in today's dollars that he handed over to them at one time in an attempt to convince the Assyrian king to give up his invasion and just go back home or go find somebody else to bother. So it's a tremendous amount of wealth that was handed over. And this is again, one of those things that is sort of documented also in the non-biblical record. The reddish thing there over here, it's a little hard to see. It's a It's a picture probably taken through a glass case of something called Sennacherib's prism. I don't know if you remember last week, I had shown a picture of a fragment of Sargon's prison, which was the same kind of thing. It's a clay tablet, basically, multi-sided clay tablet, maybe 10 or 12 inches across the top, maybe 2 or 3 feet tall. They use these to document for multiple things. This just happens to be one that was found in which Sennacherib recorded many of his deeds. And one of the things that Sennacherib recorded was exactly this, that from this Jewish king Hezekiah, because of my terrifying splendor, he turned over this tremendous amount of wealth to me because he was so afraid of me. And that's how Sennacherib recorded the events of that day. Well, despite the fact that this huge bribe had been paid, Sennacherib didn't want just money. Sennacherib wanted to conquer and punish the Jews for revolting against him in the first place. So he continued his military preparations. Meanwhile, Hezekiah, not being a foolish man and recognizing that even, I'm guessing that Hezekiah knew there was a good chance that he couldn't trust Sennacherib, that he couldn't trust the Assyrians. So even though he had handed over this tremendous amount of wealth, he continued to make preparations. And one of the things that Hezekiah did was to stockpile weapons and shields for the people of Jerusalem to defend themselves. If you remember last week, one of the things I talked about is most armies in this day and age, in almost every country, were citizen armies. There might be a small cohort of professional soldiers that served as the king's bodyguard or that were guards in major cities or palaces, that kind of thing. But the majority of the fighting men were just like you and me. You know, when the call went out, we'd all go grab our, you know, they were like the Minutemen. The call went out, they'd grab their musket and hat and a horn of powder and go out to the town square and assemble and get ready to fight off the redcoats. Well, in this case, it would be all the citizens of Jerusalem, all the men of fighting age, men in their 20s all the way up into men in their 60s, would grab whatever weapons they had available so they could go help defend the city. So one of the things that Hezekiah had already done ahead of time was, instead of having everybody just show up with what they had, he stockpiled spears and swords and shields so that he could equip the men that were going to defend the city. And the reference is made in Isaiah 22. I talked about this a little bit last week. In Isaiah 22, Isaiah prophesies about the eventual destruction of Jerusalem. And he refers back to this time when preparations were made to defend Jerusalem against the Assyrians. And he talks about the things that the Jews did in that day to prepare to fight the Assyrians. And he refers to them, "You looked in that day to the armor of the house of the forest." The house of the forest is something that Solomon built. The picture on the right side of this slide is just a depiction of what it might have looked like based on the detailed description that's in the Bible. The Bible says that the house of the forest was about 100 cubits long across the front, 50 cubits deep, and 30 cubits high. Well, that's a pretty good sized building. That's 300 feet wide across the front. That's 10 times the width of this stage, 50 cubits deep and 30 cubits high. 30 cubits is about 45 feet. So this is a pretty impressive building. And one of the things that's puzzled archaeologists and students of the Bible and others throughout the ages has been, what was the purpose of the House of the Forest of Lebanon? Because although we're told a lot about it, we're told that how big it was and what it was made of. It was primarily made of cedar. And we're told that Solomon hung gold shields in there. It's really unknown whether he built this as a secondary palace or as a big feasting hall or as a palace for one of his wives. Although some say because of the fact that he was storing armor in there that it might have just been a storehouse. It might have been a storehouse for valuable things treasure, but especially weapons. And so that's what this phrase in Isaiah means. You looked in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. The weapons and arms that were stored in this place were what the Jews were counting on to help defend their city. This is another picture, again, just a drawing based on the description that's in the Bible. Some artists decided that this is maybe what it looked like. And I'm really glad that these measurements over here are unclear, because somebody couldn't do conversion very well, because I'm pretty sure 50 meters and 100 feet aren't the same thing anywhere. If you're a school teacher and have to deal with that, you probably... Well, I don't know. The kids in my class might do that. In 1 Kings... This is what we're told about the house of the forest of Lebanon that Solomon built. I've talked about that a little bit. And like I said, primarily it was built of cedar. And although this is slightly off topic, it's just one of those things that always fascinate me. This is a modern cedar in the country of Lebanon. It's one of the few surviving large examples. You know from the Bible that cedar was imported by David and Solomon and other kings of Israel and Judah in large quantities. Cedar from Lebanon was imported by Egyptian pharaohs. In fact, there's a remains of a boat found in an Egyptian tomb. The boat's at least 3,000 years old. It's made out of Lebanese cedar. Lebanon, although it's been deforested for the most part, you would not recognize the Lebanon of today if you compared it to the Lebanon of this day and age, when Lebanon was covered with huge cedar trees. In fact, they built boats out of it, they built ships out of it, they built houses out of it. They use it for just about every purpose. In fact, pieces of chariot, again, in Egyptian tombs found, again, made out of Lebanese cedar. It was a very versatile wood. Cedar doesn't rot very easily. It's got a resin in it that stands up to bugs, stands up to rot. Unfortunately, it also makes it susceptible to fire, which is probably why there are no remnants of the house of the forest of Lebanon. Anyway, this is a large example of one of the trees that still stands in Lebanon. I hope you can make this out. There's a guy standing right there. That's a man. And that's the width of that tree from there to there. So I don't know how wide across that tree is, but it's at least 6 or 7 feet across at that point, maybe more. So the cedars of Lebanon, in their day, there were a lot of them, and they were huge trees. And I know that's off the subject that I was going to talk about today, but again, I just find that fascinating, because when I think of cedar trees, I think of the cedar trees we have around here, and most of them, I got one in my backyard, it's about 30 feet tall, and I think it's a monster. It's really not that big. Anyway, back to the subject of this morning. I'm going to put you all asleep talking about trees. In Hezekiah's day, Jerusalem was different than it is now. On this map, this line, this solid line here, represents what are called the old city walls today. The old city walls that are standing in Jerusalem today are not the city walls that would have been standing in the time of Hezekiah. They're not even the walls that would have been standing in the time of Jesus, because the Romans leveled all those walls. When the Romans sacked Jerusalem in AD 70, and they completely leveled the city walls. None of those are standing. I mean, there are fragments, but there are no walls standing from that day. And when they came back 200 years later, or 160 years later, following one of the Jewish revolts, anything that had been built since then was again leveled again. However, buried underground are the fragments of the walls that did exist in Hezekiah's day. And this is Temple Mount here. This double line here represents the modern day, or the Temple Mount of Herod's day. And then this dotted line represents some best guesses about where the walls of Jerusalem would have been in Hezekiah's time. Well, another thing that Hezekiah did besides stockpiling arms, weapons, and shields was to rebuild the fortifications that were already in existence. Not because they'd been damaged necessarily by war, but these are masonry and brick walls. They just wear out over time. And it's just like in America today. You know, when the army or the armed forces aren't needed, they're kind of neglected and forgotten about. And they can decay, things that, you know, that you're going to count on later, they just kind of fall apart. Well, we'll get to that later. Same thing had happened here. Walls had fallen down. My guess is that there are people out there who are probably stealing bits and pieces of the walls because they needed some extra bricks or stone at home. And so they had to make repairs. The other thing he did was strengthen this thing called the Milo. Again, this is another one of those things that I've read different accounts on. Some people claim that the Milo refers to terraces that were built to strengthen the fortifications that were actually around the Temple Mount area. And some claim that the Milo was actually a fortification itself, that it was some type of keep, if you will, like you would have found in medieval times, kind of like a final fortress, and it would have been rebuilt on top of the original Jebusite fortification that would have been found in the area of Jerusalem. One of the things it also says is that he built another outside wall in 2 Chronicles. And again, this is referring back to that prophecy of Isaiah where he talked about the things the Jews had done to prepare in the past for the defense of their city. Well, this here is a piece of the wall that Hezekiah built in Jerusalem during his day and age. This wall was buried under earth, rubble from centuries past, has finally been excavated. There's a section of this wall that's about 600 and some odd feet long that's been uncovered so far. And this is just the bottom of the wall. A few feet up from the bottom of the wall. This isn't how high the wall would have said. Like I said, when the Romans leveled Jerusalem, they really did a good job of leveling it. So this was all underground until not too long ago. That red arrow indicates the width of that wall, which was about 22 feet. So pretty good size. About two-thirds the width of the stage is how wide that wall was. And if you remember one of the comments I made last week about the way they would have built walls, you can kind of see along the edge here, you can see stones that are kind of joined. They were rough cut into rectangular shapes, not perfectly dressed and stacked. So there would have been a casing on each side of the wall, on the outside, and then the interior of the wall would have just been filled with rubble, broken stones, brick, wood, whatever kind of trash rubble that was laying around would have been used to fill the interior of that wall. Well, one of the things that Isaiah said in Isaiah 22 is, you numbered the houses of Jerusalem and the houses you broke down to fortify the wall. Well, again, that's kind of a puzzler, except that within this section of wall, and I can't tell you exactly where, but somewhere in that section of wall, they found the foundation of a house. And what the archaeologist surmises is that while Hezekiah was building this wall, that there were houses in the way. And exercising the principle that we know today as eminent domain, the people in those houses lost their houses. Their houses became part of the wall, or they were rubbled, torn down, and used to fill the interior of the wall. They probably cleared an area on each side of the wall, or certainly on the enemy side of the wall, they would have cleared out the houses. And all that material that they took from those houses would have been used to build this wall. And additionally, like I said, they would have used, if there were houses on the path of the wall, they would have just become part of the wall. They would have filled the house with rubble and maybe added another length, course of stone to the outside to strengthen it. And then that house effectively became part of this fortification that Hezekiah built. Again, this is an artist's concept of what it might have been. Jerusalem in the day of David was very small. Solomon expanded the city. So then in Solomon's day, Jerusalem would have been that long, narrow city that extended across those high places. But like any other city, there was urban sprawl, especially on the west sides. The folks would have continued to build houses, shops, whatever, and the city expanded out from what was the original city here. The city grew out this way. Archaeologists know that's what happened. And again, there are some who study those texts in the Bible and say, well, that's what this refers to when it says Hezekiah built another outside wall. Is there may have been some fortifications already started out here, but Hezekiah wasn't going to sacrifice the city of Jerusalem to invaders. So they completed this exterior wall to enclose the majority of those houses and people that were living outside of the original city walls. This area up here where it makes a little dip, somewhere in that area is where that section of wall that I just showed you in the previous slide, that's where that section of wall would have been. Something else I was trying to remember to say here. I'm going to continue on. One of the other things that Hezekiah did in preparing Jerusalem for an eventual attack by the Assyrians was to ensure that he had a water supply for the city, but also to keep the enemy from having a water supply. One of the things about Jerusalem is there are not very many sources of fresh water that are readily available in that area. It's a precious commodity. It was then. Today it's even worse because some of the original springs have dried up. But one of the things that Hezekiah did after consulting with his other leaders was to close up the springs that were in the area, or at least cover them up so they couldn't be found by the enemy. Of course, he couldn't just cover them up or fill them in or destroy them because he still needed the water supply for the city. This is a picture. I think this picture is from back early 1900s. It was taken showing probably an Arab girl. She's not, it may not be clear in this picture, but that's a very small girl carrying a small jug in her head. That's not a woman. And she is coming up the steps from the spring called Gihon, which is on the east side of Jerusalem, down in the Kidron Valley. It's much lower than the city of Jerusalem, the city that David and Solomon had built. The opening down into this spring area, I don't know that it looks exactly like this today. If some of you have been to Jerusalem, you might be able to tell me. But it's still very similar. You can still walk down steps into where the water of the Gihon Spring still flows. At the time of Hezekiah, it's said that tons of water flowed out of the Gihon Spring every minute. Well, I don't know how much a ton of water is. I don't know how many gallons that is, but that's a lot of water. Tons of water were flowing out. So it was a very productive spring, supplied a lot of the water for the city. And I apologize for this, but I forgot to put my watch on this morning. Marvin, can you tell me what time it is? What time? I'm just trying to...
It's almost 10.
Okay, I just want to make sure that I'm keeping pace here, that I don't run out of time. So, Hezekiah blocked up springs, or at least closed up the openings external to the city that others might find to keep the Assyrians from getting water. But he also had to ensure that he got water into the city. And I'm sure you've all heard of Hezekiah's tunnel. This is a picture supposedly taken around 1905 of some people going through, or 1935, I think, of some people going through Hezekiah's tunnel. And I'm going to continue on here. This red dotted line represents the path of that tunnel from over here. This is Gihon Spring. Down here is the Pool of Siloam. And so this red dotted line from there all the way to there represents an underground tunnel that was dug. It was dug quickly. And in fact, again, it's one of those things that people who have studied it have questions about and wonder why it follows the path that it follows, because I thought maybe it followed the softest stone. Well, it doesn't. In some places, it goes through the absolute hardest stone and bypasses softer stone on either side. But for whatever reason, it follows this winding path. That path is over 1,700 feet long. It was all done without modern surveying tools. It was done without modern excavating equipment. And it was done in a matter of months, if not weeks, from start to finish. It's absolutely amazing that they're able to do that. That number over there indicates the grade of that tunnel from start to finish. That's not 0.06, it's 0.06%. If you translated 0.06% grade, if you went from that point over there on the far side of those stairs to that point over there on that far side of the stairs, that's a drop of less than a quarter of an inch from there to there. I guarantee you that there are quarter-inch variances in that stage from that side to that side. That's an absolutely incredible engineering feat, okay, the fact that they're able to do that. And it has that nice gradual slope because you don't want the water. You know, water flows faster on steeper slopes. You don't want the water where it's coming out over here at tons per minute, coming out over here at tons per minute like a fire hose. So it's a nice gradual slope, just enough to keep the water flowing and fill up this area down here. Isaiah also said in Isaiah 22, countdown clock, that you made a reservoir between the two walls. And we know for a fact that there were two walls at the southern end of the city of David, and that's where those pools led into that Hezekiah's tunnel led to. The tunnel, like I said, still exists today. If you're brave, you go to Jerusalem, you can walk from that tunnel from start to finish. Like I said, the water doesn't flow as deep now as it did back then. I think there are spots where you probably get above your knees, but that's about it. I think they said it's about a 35, 40-minute walk if you wanted to brave that. I personally, no thank you. It's underground. This is an inscription that was found. Let me go back one. Right here on that path, there's kind of a little curlicue. That's where the tunnelers met because they actually started digging the tunnel from both ends at the same time. This is an inscription that talks about how the two teams of tunnelers met. This inscription was found carved in the stone inside the tunnel some years back when the Turks still controlled Palestine. The Turks cut it out of the wall and took it back. It's still today. That stone is in a museum in Istanbul, Turkey. But it talks about the tunnelers, tunneling from the two sides and how they hurt each other and how they finally made the eventual link up. So, if you're not amazed by the fact that that tunnel winds and still ends up in the right place, if you're not amazed by the fact that it had a 0.06% grade, the fact that they dug from two different points and still managed to intersect underground, to me, again, absolutely amazing. So, Jerusalem's soon to be under siege. The army's approaching. Messengers from Sennacherib have come demanding Hezekiah surrender. I talked about this during my sermon last Sunday, that finally Hezekiah does what he considers the last resort, which maybe should have been the first thing he does. He goes and delivers this prayer. And he offers a prayer to God, not just to protect Hezekiah, but really, if you read that prayer, one of the main things that he appeals to God is, you need to punish these people who have blasphemed against you. I mean, he doesn't say it outright, but in my mind, I can almost hear him say, forget about me, this isn't about me. They've blasphemed God himself. Well, again, you know how this story ends. An angel of the Lord destroys the Assyrian army. 185,000 Assyrian soldiers who have gathered outside Jerusalem are all killed at one time. And their corpses are seen by the people the next day. Now, there are people who poo-poo this, historians and you know, the secular historians who say that never really happened. What really happened was that Sennacherib took the bribe from Hezekiah and just gave up and left. Well, this is my view of the world. Because, like I said, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I can read and write, and I can read maps, too. That red arrow right there points to a little itty-bitty thing right there, which is the kingdom of Judah, what's left of it, with Jerusalem right up there in the northern part. This light green area, all of this light green area are areas that were conquered by Tiglath-Pileser, Sargon, Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, who is Sennacherib's son or his successor, and possibly some other Assyrian generals that were involved. Because after Sennacherib went back to the Assyrian capital, and it wasn't for almost 20 years, he was murdered as prophesied or as recorded in the Bible, he was murdered by two men who then fled, and Esarhaddon and his son took the throne and continued Assyrian conquest. And it wasn't until after the Assyrians gave up on Jerusalem and Judah that they went down and conquered Egypt. And so they conquered, they kept conquering, they kept attacking, except for one area. All the rest of this was completely conquered, controlled by the Assyrians, except for that little spot right there, Jerusalem and Judah. Well, the historians can say whatever they want. The Assyrians were not the kind of guys that gave up. Okay? They kept going. In fact, one of the reasons the Assyrian Empire fell eventually is because they didn't give up. They kept fighting. If you resisted them, they kept fighting you. It was like the guy, you know, it was like a bulldog. Just won't give up till he's dead. Well, that's the way the Assyrians were. They didn't give up till they were dead. And they lost large numbers of their professional soldiers doing that. Well, this is another picture of Sennacherib's prism. And this is what he said about Hezekiah. He said Hezekiah would not submit. So he caged him up in Jerusalem. Again, I'll go back to this. The Assyrian armies, there were still Assyrian armies or Assyrian soldiers available to the Assyrians to attack Jerusalem. The Assyrians never gave up once they started a battle. And yet here we have in Sennacherib's own history that Hezekiah just wouldn't give up, so I closed him up in his city and left him. Okay? That's not the Assyrians. That's not what the Assyrians would have done. And it's certainly not what the Assyrians would have done when they could have easily have surrounded Jerusalem had God not intervened. They could have surrounded Jerusalem and just starved out the inhabitants. Or they could have done what they did at Lachish. Or they could have done what they did at any number of other cities that were defended throughout the Middle East that they always conquered and prevailed against, to include Babylon, to include Thebes in Egypt, and every other major city in Egypt. But for some reason, Hezekiah wouldn't submit. They just left him alone. Well, I can think of a really good reason why they just left him alone. When 185,000 men die in one night, it's probably a good message to you and yours that we've got something wrong here. Maybe we may better move on. Maybe they didn't believe in Jehovah. Maybe they didn't believe in the Lord of hosts. But they knew that there was something bigger than them, bigger than their gods, that was helping to defend Jerusalem. And they essentially gave up, left Jerusalem alone, and went on to easier prey, like Egypt. That's it for what I had to present. Does anybody have any questions? I don't know how much time we have left. About 7 or 8 minutes. Anybody have any questions or comments? If not, that's all I have. I appreciate your attention. Thank you very much.